Anybody who's been listening to Sports Byline USA for a long time knows that we're associated with the military through our broadcast on the American Forces Network. We've been with them for more than 20 years, and probably the highlight of my career has been my trips to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo. And I came across a story about a young man. He's 24 years old. His name is Daniel Rodriguez, and he's a wide receiver walk-on at Clemson University, going to Clemson on the GI Bill. He enlisted as an Army infantryman and soon started a 15-month tour in Iraq. He returned home for a year and then was deployed to Afghanistan. And we'll talk a little bit more about that story. But when he came back, he fulfilled a promise to his best friend who was killed over in Afghanistan. And Daniel, when I looked at your story and I thought about it, you were such a young man when you went into the military. And it was tragedy that directed you in that direction as well, because your dad, Ray, who had been a military man himself, tragically passed away as you graduated from high school. That's an awful lot to take on as a young man. Tell me a little bit about how you endured.
It was a difficult time in my life. I had just graduated high school, and 4 days later, my father passed away, and I was just stuck with this dilemma almost, and I could either be there in my hometown and make excuses of why I didn't do anything or why I didn't go off to school. But I ultimately just had to make a decision to grow up and become my own man. And I just went to the enlisting agency there and didn't tell my mom or sister. And I said, hey, I want to see Europe and jump out of planes and be infantry. And I didn't jump out of any planes, barely saw Europe, and they said, sign right here. So that's kind of how it played out, and next thing I knew, I was being shipped off to Fort Benning, Georgia, and it was just kind of a tragic time in my life, but it was ultimately one of the best decisions I made, just to really establish some fundamentals in my life and really grow up to who I am today. So it was a tough time.
Yeah, how did you break it to your mother that you'd signed up for the Army?
It was difficult. I just went home, and it was only maybe 2-3 weeks after my father's funeral. And I told my mom and sister I wanted to take them out to lunch. And, I kind of broke them the news. And they're like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah, I've already done it, actually. And they're like, well, when do you leave? And I said, I leave in 4 days. And they were a little, distraught over the fact that I had joined during a time of war, being, in the peak of the conflict during the Bush administration back then in 06. So they were a little uneasy with it. But at the same time, they knew they just had to support me and be as supportive as they could of my decision. So it was tough for them. It was tough for all of us. But, I ultimately, made the decision and took off.
You grew up in Stafford, Virginia. You started playing football when you were 6 years old. You were a little bit on the small side, and several Division II and Division III schools recruited you. But you said, I was undersized and our program was still being built. Tell me about those early football days.
Yeah, I was always undersized in every sport I played. But it just wasn't a factor to me. I knew I could always compete, and going through high school, we had a program, a fairly new high school when I was going through it, and it was just one of those building phases. You finally establish a program, a head coach, and you really see a vision for the program to go, and we had a group of guys that were really committed, and we changed the program around. Now it's a very successful program in Northern Virginia, and it was just what it was. We didn't have a lot of big names when I was there, so not a lot of recruitments went in and out of there. So you really just had to fight for the playing time you had and hope for the best. But now that the program's evolved, really being a trailblazer, my classmates and I, we have a lot of D1 athletes coming in and out of there. So it's really cool to look back and see what it's become, and that I'm actually being a part of that timeline with Division I athletes coming out of that high school again. So it's really cool to look back and see where we've gone from there.
I want to talk a little bit more about your military career because of my experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan as well. One thing that I saw when I was over there was how people grew up. I mean, you almost had to. You thrust kids that were 18, 19, 20, 21 years old into combat situations, something that is not normal in one's life. And your first tour was a 15-month deployment to Baghdad, and I got your quote here. You said it was really eye-opening being so young and exposed to what I was exposed to, and you described it as your days kicking down doors and being targeted with roadside bombs and small arms fire. I was there when all of that was coming down in the early days of the war, and I'm just wondering, the first time you got into that situation, what were your impressions and your thoughts, Daniel?
It all feels surreal. I mean, even when it's happening, I was 18 years old and, shipped off to to war, and you have that adrenaline in you. And being of a competitive nature like I was, it's very difficult to show any kind of fear as far as, you know, to your peers. And it was just one of those things where I was always up to volunteer and always down to be the first one through if needed to be, even though, you know, I had, you know, fear inside of me. But you kick down those first doors, you know, middle of the night with your knobs on, and you're sitting there in a room full of people screaming. You've got, you know, your weapon pointed at the males, and you're zip-tying them up, and you're just going through the house trying to find, you know, stuff. You know, you've got pings on these guys, and you know they're bad guys and responsible for stuff, and you don't realize the effect that it has on you and just the daunting nature of what that does to a person at such a young age when you come back to the States and have to adapt back to civilization in a normal way. And for me, you know, a 15-month tour, I declined my leave too, because what had happened essentially is when I came out of basic, they made me take my leave for Christmas and stay home because I was deploying to Iraq so fast. I deployed 24 days after I graduated basic, so I took all the leave I had gained from basic training. So when I went to Iraq, they gave me an option to take leave, but I was going to go in the hole. So I said, well, screw it. I'm just going to do my 15-month tour and save all my leave up. So I never got to go home. You know, I stuck it out the entire time, and it was just a price. You know, it was a price you pay, you know, living that lifestyle and, you know, in and out of missions constantly. I lived at a joint security site in the middle of Baghdad with Iraqi police, just doing missions in and out of Baghdad for a week at a time before we even got back to our FOB to refit. So, you know, no showers, no food, just, you know, really on a daily grind, guarding, in and out of sleep, you know, due to attacks and small arms coming in. And, you know, you really have that mindset of just being a cluster, you know. And I had just turned 19 when I came home, and then you tell me I can't buy a beer of what I just saw? Come on now. You know, it was a tough time in my life to really go through that phase coming home from Iraq and seeing what I saw over there. It was eye-opening, to say the least.
Yeah, it is eye-opening and mind-bending as well. And one of the things that I've thought is really unfair is to yank somebody out of a deployment, especially a combat deployment where they've seen action, send them home back to normalcy for 2 weeks, and then bring them back and put them in that same environment. And I know the nights that I spent up till 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning talking with soldiers, because the great thing about what we were doing, Daniel, was that sports was kind of a bridge. You know, I mean, it was a normalcy. It was a part of like being home. Tell me about the Redskins. Tell me about the Chicago Bulls. And I understood them reaching out for something that was normal, because everything they were seeing around them was not normal. And it was hard for them to, the kids would say to me, it was hard to go home and go to a shopping center and then all of a sudden have to go back out and gird yourself for combat and what you didn't know was around the corner.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, having that bridge with athletics and sports, because I was in the same boat. You know, we stayed up for AFN 2, 3 in the morning to see your team play and just, you know, try to get bits and pieces of what you could. And I know the feeling. It's kind of crazy bringing me back to those days, but just thankful I made it home.
You came back and you were home for a year, and then you redeployed to Afghanistan. And going to Afghanistan was a little bit different. When I was there, I noted a difference. What did you see as a combat soldier in Afghanistan as compared to Iraq?
For us, we were kind of out in the wild, wild west, is what we called it. luckily, I got to stay with the same unit that I did with Iraq. So we had a core of most guys that I had deployed with, you know, just some new guys came in here and there, and, you know, the casualties we took, we had our replacements come in for our new deployment. But, you know, we got out of Baghdad, you know, just this concrete jungle, and, you know, for you being there, it's actually a very beautiful, architecturally designed city, minus the bombs and bullet holes everywhere. And you come from that environment to the middle of the mountains on the Pakistan border of just this jungle, thick Kamdesh, Hindu Kush mountains, and you're just like, where in the world are we? You know, in the middle of nowhere. And we were the furthest north troops in Afghanistan at the time, located at Kop Keating, right on the Pakistan border. And it was a culture shock. It really was. We didn't get mail. We got one meal a day. We didn't have showers. There was just 38 of us out there on this mountaintop, you know, growing our hair long, having our beards, and literally fighting every day. I think we were something like 70-something troops in contact in the first 2 months we were there. We were literally seeing combat every day. And there were no rules. You know, we called it the Wild West because there was no call-ups out there. You know, we called up when we were getting hit hard and we needed air support, but we were literally on guard 24/7, and we'd fight back. You know, there was no collateral damage. There were no people walking around like in Baghdad. Like, if you were getting shot at, there was nothing to, you know, there was nowhere you didn't have to aim. You're just shooting back, you know what I mean? So it's like one of these transitions. And another thing, in Baghdad, half of our casualties were sniper fire and IEDs, where in Afghanistan, I was literally seeing the guys I was shooting at fighting us toe-to-toe. So it was a complete different combat zone. You know, they'd hit you with indirect and small arms and get right up on you, you know. In Iraq, it wasn't like that. You were just patrolling almost like a police patrol, and, you know, every now and then you'd get some small arms, or, you know, you're really just waiting on EOD to clear something out and kicking down doors at night, where Afghanistan was. It was a toe-to-toe fight. Those boys, they had some balls on them, man. I tip my hat to them Afghans. They knew how to fight, and they weren't scared of you. So it was a complete different war zone.
You know, you mentioned about the 38 men that you were with over in Afghanistan. That's almost like a team as well. Tell me a little bit about how the teamwork at the military level with these guys that you'd been with in Iraq and now are with in Afghanistan. How does that work?
You know, I think for the soldiers out there can kind of relate. You know, the longer you stay in the military, you know, with your unit, and you have this cohesive bond with the guy next to you. You know, they're your family, essentially. And then when you're in such isolated conditions, out in the middle of nowhere, you feel like they're literally your brothers. You know, you're staying up on hours of the night on guard just learning about stories from their past and, you know, their family, their loved ones, their girlfriends, their exes. You know, you just sit there and talk to them. And you really get to know them because you're in this state of just utter confusion almost, in the sense of you have nobody but the guy next to you wearing the American flag, and that becomes your safe haven. And, you know, that's what a platoon was to us, and we were so isolated out there. Everybody knew everything about each other. You know, we were very open. We had to share our food. We had to, you know, share our baby wipes. You know, we shared bunks. You know, you got to cuddle with your buddy when it gets cold. You know, we slept in the side of a cave for who knows how long. It was hollowed out, and we had plywood for bunk beds and ammo cans for dumbbells, and we were just making the most of what we had out there, living these mountain-style lives for the year we were supposed to be out there. And that's what it becomes. It just becomes a second-nature family, and you know, it's tough. You know, you're out there fighting, and that's how it is, you know, and I can't say more than that just because that's really all you are, is just a family, and it's a good feeling.
Yeah, and part of your family was a dear, dear friend of yours. Tell me about Kevin Thompson.
Yeah, Kevin Thompson, PFC Thompson. He was actually one of my first soldiers. I just got promoted E5. I made my E5 in about 3 years. I fast-tracked pretty quick, and right before we deployed, we got some new guys in, and Thompson was assigned to me. So, you know, I had just gotten back from long-range, like, sniper school and LRM and air assault. So I had to train up the new guys to go over. And, you know, he was one of my guys from Reno, Nevada, really funny kid, bigger guy, you know, just to kind of energize, always put a smile on your face no matter how mad you were at him. And, you know, you deploy over there, you know, and fraternization kind of goes out the window with some leniency when you're in such extreme conditions. Like, you show respect to, you know, to your superiors and your NCOs, but ultimately, you know, when the gunfire starts, you know, you guys are all just fighting for the same reason, to stay alive. So you really just get on a good level with your superiors out there. And that's how me and him were. We were good friends, and, you know, we just got to know each other. And, you know, we were just talking one day about what we wanted to do when we get out of the military. And I told him, you know, I wanted to go back and play football and try to walk on somewhere and get an education. And I promised him I'd do it. And unfortunately, he was killed about 2 weeks later in one of the bloodiest battles in Afghanistan to this day. So it was unfortunate, but he was a very good guy.
Tell me about October 3rd, 2009.
Yeah, it's a day that always reaps a spot in my memory, that's for sure. It was a normal day. You know, we for about a month or so, we were getting reports just of ICOM chatter that we were going to get overrun by 300 to 400 Taliban. And, you know, every night we'd hear it, and we'd go out on guard to stand by. And then after a month, you realize they're just calling, crying wolf. So you kind of loosen up your restraints a little bit. And then next thing you know, it's October 3rd, 2009, and the sun just came up. And I went down to use the computer to go, the one computer on the base, to go send an email. to my family, and before I knew it, the Rockets were coming in, and I didn't realize how bad it was, but ultimately it was one of the bloodiest battles in Afghanistan, and we were completely overrun. I took some shrapnel through my legs and neck. I had a bullet fragment through my shoulder. 8 Americans were killed. We killed about 125 in and around the wire. I threw who knows how many hand grenades, melted some barrels, had my sniper rifle, had handgun kills, shotguns. We were trying to blow claymores, and you know, it's just one of these times where it's just you're not sure what's going to happen. And at the end of the day, you know, 8 Americans are killed, a 9th one ends up dying, and 22 of you are wounded, and everything's burnt to the ground around you, and you're just praying for reinforcements because you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. And it was a pretty devastating day. It was about an 18-hour fight. You know, we couldn't even get birds in to get our wounded. We had an Apache hit, almost shot down. We had B-52s go Winchester, which is when they dumped their entire payload, and that had happened one time since the war had started, and we had it happen twice in one day. And, you know, recalling it, going back and talking with the Air Force boys, they're like, you know, we don't even practice anything 600 meters or in. That's just considered danger close and suicide. And we were having 2,000-pound bombs dropped within a football field of us because it was either they do it or we die. You know, and it's just one of those things where you don't even kill if the care if the concussion of your own bombs kill you, just as long as the Taliban doesn't do it. You know, we're out there just fighting toe-to-toe and, you know, close combat, and they're coming in over the wire, and we're just dropping them and piling them up as we can. And, you know, it was a long day, and it was a really long day, and, you know, it was well-decorated. I think we're the most decorated unit. I think we had something like 9 Silver Stars, a Medal of Honor, 22 Purple Hearts, and something crazy with BSMVs, and, you know, it's just, it's wild to look back and reflect on it, you know, that I actually survived it, but, you know, you think you're going to wake up to a normal day, and then out of nowhere, it's all hell's broken loose, and you're thinking about taking your own life if you run out of bullets. So, you know, it's kind of one of those days where you're just glad you survived it, I suppose.
Daniel was awarded the Purple Heart and the Bronze Star for combat heroism, and you were taken off the field and treated, of course, and you had a chance. You had the option to go back home, but you decided not to. Tell me how you made that decision and why.
I mean, it's fairly easy. You know, I think for my mentality and my nature, there wasn't an option. As long as I could recover and become returned to duty, I was going to do so. I don't think I could live with myself knowing I'm capable of pulling the trigger. And I got my buddies sucking it up for another 6 months of their tour, and I'm sitting at home getting fat. I just couldn't live with myself, so I'd rather be killed than, you know, go back home and know my friends got killed without me there. So it was pretty tough decision, pretty gutsy, but ultimately I knew that's what I was going to do. You really didn't have to talk me in or out of anything. I'm pretty hard-headed when it comes to me making up my mind.
You came home, and you did have problems adapting and adjusting, and you talked very candidly about it. What was it like to come home?
It was extremely difficult. So I got home from Afghanistan, and it was just one of those things. I was just trying to get the hell out. So I out-processed pretty quick, and it was an adjustment of chaos. You know, I got home thinking it was going to be okay, and the next thing I know, I'm, you know, up all night, you know, terrified. I got my concealed permit as soon as I could, and I had guns stashed away everywhere. And, you know, I just had these thoughts that, you know, the hell with anybody else as long as I make it out of it, whatever I have to do, you know. I'm thinking that I'm going to get ambushed in the grocery store. I was afraid to go to grocery stores and supermarkets or any basketball or any kind of games. I just couldn't be around any groups.
I know the question that everybody who's listening to this around the world is going to ask is, how is Daniel today?
I'm good. You know, I've found my bridge, as you put how sports were or are to so many soldiers now. You know, you find your sanity in the things that make you happy. You know, and I had to really cope with what I had gone through, and, you know, I live so close to Arlington. I have a few friends buried there, and it's a very detrimental process to come home and have nobody, and that's how I was. You know, I had some family and friends, but I was alone, And one day it hit me, you know, I just had to fulfill that promise I left to a friend, and I dedicated my entire life to doing so and not making excuses for what I had gone through, what I had seen. And it was a long road, but I kind of just quit cold turkey everything one morning and said, the hell with the life I have now. I know where I want to go, and I know what I want to do. And that was my mindset, you know, and now I'm here at Clemson, and couldn't be happier. And, you know, I still deal with, you know, minute issues as far as, you know, PTSD goes and stuff like that. But I have clarity in my life now, knowing and having structure and having goals and ambitions and to get my degree, you know, and play football. And that's who I am. You know, you can't make excuses for what you go through. You have to find positive out of all the negative you have in your life and turn it into something productive. And that's what I've done, and that's what I'm going to continue to do. So, you know, you just can't make excuses for yourself.
And when you came back, you enrolled in a community college, and you began training for football. And then you said, hey, I'm going to go for a big-time program. And you put together a video of yourself catching passes. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, my philosophy has always been, you know, kind of go big or go home. And, you know, everything I put in my life up to that point was that. So, you know, being military and, you know, going what I went through, I was like, well, shoot, if I survive that, you know, there's really nothing I can't do. And I was like, I'm going to play Division One. And my friends were just like, you know, you're kind of small. You're kind of old. Like, you know, if you're going to do it, just try to play somewhere small. I was like, nah, like, I'm going to go to the biggest school possible, and I'm going to play. And they kind of laughed at me. And, you know, I knew I was always capable of doing it. I knew I was the caliber athlete to fulfill it. I just had to just work hard. And so I put together one of my friend's cousin started a production company, and I said, hey, how much would it cost me to make a recruitment video? And he, you know, he kind of went over the details, and he goes, if I do it, I want you to tell your story. He's like, you don't understand how remarkable this is if you fulfill it. And at the time, I really didn't. I mean, even to this day, I'm just like, it's my life. Like, I knew I could do it all along. But he's like, I want to kind of capture your military, you working out. Because I had gotten in ridiculous shape, like tip-top. And my philosophy was just walk on, get accepted to a school, walk on, and be in better shape than anybody else and work my way up to a depth chart some way, somehow. And so we put together a video, ended up getting on YouTube and going viral, and had all my personal information on it, so I had to, like, take it down and resubmit it. But I got contacted by probably, like, 150 schools, and, you know, including Virginia Tech and, you know, schools even out in Hawaii contacted me. And ultimately, Coach Sweeney here at Clemson shot me an email. I was like, I'd love to talk to you. And I came down for a visit and fell in love with the place and left knowing I was going to be a Clemson Tiger. And that's kind of how it all bundled up to me being here today.
You did have somebody that supported you pretty well that was a surprise to you, was it not? Jake Tapper, ABC
yeah.
News senior White House correspondent, a friend. Tell the story about what he did for you.
Yeah, that was it was pretty wild. You know, I had been sending the video out to colleges, you know, to recruiting, and it was password protected, and on a Vimeo account, and they're like, you know, you need to make it more easily accessible. So I was like, well, screw it, I'll just put it on YouTube, and I'll see if Jake can give me a retweet. And at the time, Jake was working for ABC, and I think he's with CNN now, but he's working ABC, and he had like 250,000 followers on Twitter. And I just sent him a text message. I was like, hey, do you mind tweeting out this video? I just kind of want to play college football. Let me, you know, he's like, yeah, I don't know how many people play college football or know anybody that plays football or any association on my Twitter followers, but sure, why the hell not? And I went to bed that night and woke up with about 6,000 emails. So it kind of took a turn to positive town real quick. And like I said, all my personal information was at the end of the original video, so I had text messages coming in, voicemails, emails, letters in the mail from all over, and that kind of turned into me flying up, being on, like, Fox and Friends and Sports Illustrated, and it was pretty wild for about a month, and then I had to go back to school because I was all over Christmas break, so my Christmas break was pretty crazy.
Daniel, I know that with college teams, and particularly the high profile ones like Clemson is there's kind of a pecking order on teams. I mean, the kids that get recruited heavily know, you know, that they are living a certain type of life. But when you're a walk-on, it's a little bit different. Do you feel the life experiences you had prepared you better to deal with the fact that you were at the bottom of the chain? And what type of experiences did you have to overcome to be able to prove yourself a worthy player at that level of competition?
You have to realize, you know, all the kids that they have on their program, they've recruited for years, months, you know, hours, you know, building a relationship with them, their family, you know, to bring them in. And that's ultimately who they have their investment in. You know, they're paying for their school. So you come in as a walk-on, you know, it's very difficult to get your foot in the door and really make a name for yourself. But luckily, our coach here, Coach Sweeney, was a former walk-on at Alabama and went on to win a national championship back in the day. So he has a very, very positive mindset when it comes to the best person's going to play. Like, he doesn't care if he recruited you, if you're not living up to your potential or somebody's better than you and they're a nobody, it doesn't matter. They're the best man's going to play. So I was really given a great opportunity to compete, and that's all I needed was a chance to compete, you know, not sit on the sideline. And it was very hard for me, but I spent hours upon hours in the film room just learning the offense, this complex offense that we have with our offensive coordinator, Coach Morris, and learning all the hand signals and doing as much as I could. And, you know, I knew my shot was going to come on special teams. And, you know, I just one day in practice, I had been working my way up the depth chart, and I got on the starting team and never looked back. You know, I started every game on kickoff, and I did some punt returns this year. And I had 3 catches for 9 yards, so I just knew that the opportunity would come if I kept working, and this year is no different. And, you know, I'm more of a veteran now, and I know the offense, and I know the coaches, so I'm really looking forward to getting more playing time and being more of an impact player on the team as best as I can.
I want to ask you about another significant date, and that was October the 20th, 2012. You carried the American flag down the hill for Military Appreciation Day at Clemson, and it was also your dad's birthday. Tell me about that day.
Yeah, it was very significant. It was a fairly surreal moment. You know, they told me that Military Appreciation Day here was pretty big, being a military school, Clemson, until 1955. So they have a very huge heritage of military history here. And they're like, you know, we're going to lead the team down the hill. It was my father's birthday, going against a school that I rooted for my entire life and essentially wanted to play for it. So, you know, just coming down the hill with the flag and, you know, getting the ovation and seeing the support and troops and veterans in the stands, it was awesome. You know, you live up to a moment in your life where you realize that your hard work has paid off, and it was in that moment where I really felt that I had achieved something. You know, I haven't achieved everything I wanted to, but that was pretty cool to have that recognition and the support of my team and community and friends here at Clemson, just like, be in that moment and realize that what I was doing was something I had set off to do so long ago. So it was so cool, and I couldn't have been happier and more proud and honored to do it. It was an emotional day as well, but overall it was amazing, incredible feeling.
And you ran into some Air Force pilots, did you not?
I did. That was pretty wild. They actually contacted the Pentagon and got the actual pilots that had dropped bombs for me that day, and brought them in to give them an ovation and to surprise me. So, you know, I was sitting on the sideline before the fourth quarter, and I'm like, what the heck is going on? And, you know, I'm hearing what they're saying over the loudspeaker, and then I realize it dawns on me, like, hey, if it wasn't for those two guys out there, I wouldn't even be playing at all. You know, if it wasn't for air support, we'd all been dead, you know. So I just ran out there and kind of was just like, thanks, guys. You know, I don't have much time to talk. We still got fourth quarter to play. But, you know, it was really cool to meet them. I got to spend some time with them after the game and just kind of talk to them and, you know, hear their side of it. And they heard my side of it. And, you know, we would have never knew each other if we would have sat at the dinner table together. And, you know, you know what I mean? So it's pretty awkward to know that those are the guys that really had a hand in helping you out.
Any final thoughts in the minute we have left about the whole experience, your life experience to this point?
Yeah, you know, it's tough. But the way I see it, I've had the same kind of mindset as far as aggravation towards people's immature thoughts. And I've come to terms with it's not their fault. It's not your fault. Everything we do in the military as veterans, it was a volunteer. It was a volunteer army. You know, we were the men we were, the women we are because of the contract and, you know, our hand over our heart swearing in. And to come back and to adapt to a lifestyle of maybe not so many people aware of what's going on, it, you know, it's selfish for us to get, I felt it was selfish for me to get angry at those people because their lifestyle has no effect on mine. And you just have to stay positive and stay the course with your life, and everything will pan out as long as you're focused on what you want to do. And that's kind of what I've been living my life by, and it seemed to be working out so far so good.
Daniel, I want to thank you very, very much for sharing your story and being so candid and so open. I can already anticipate the reaction that I'm going to get from this interview, and I just want to thank you for your service, you and the other servicemen and women, for your service to this country.
Ron, I appreciate you having me on.
Daniel Rodriguez with us, wide receiver walk-on at Clemson University, attending Clemson on a GI Bill. We'll take a break, continue with more of You and America's Sports Talk Show.